When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Big publishers are talking E3, PlayStation VR 2 is finally here, and Call of Duty is going to make your Nintendo Switch explode. This is VGC, a video games podcast with me, Jordan Midler, Andy Robinson, and Pete Donaldson. How are we doing, folks?
Very good, mate. How are you?
I'm not bad, you know. We're kind of getting out of the busy season, but after being stuck in the guides mines.
Out of the busy season is February.
Yeah, but
you're only getting started, mate.
There's no big games for a while now, though. It's like, I can just...
Yeah, Resident Evil 4 next month.
Yeah, but that's an Andy Robinson joint. I wasn't even born when the first Resident Evil came out.
It does feel like everyone's dodging out of the way of Zelda as well, right?
Yeah, big time. What about you, Pete? How are you doing?
I'm good. I've been enjoying your, just general Twitter badinage, Jordan, and also your time spent with the PSVR helmet. What's it like being in the real world and things you can touch? Because you've spent a week or so in the with a helmet on your head.
It's strange because the PlayStation VR 2, because we'll talk about this a bit later, but because it is so light, It's the only time in a VR space that I've had the... Oh crap! I'm wearing this big plastic thing. I could put my fist through a shelving unit in my room. Whereas usually, because I have a ginormous head, the headsets are like compressing my skull to the point where the immersion is completely bust.
It slows you down when you get your head in a vice, isn't it?
Yeah. I've peeled myself away from the virtual reality to join you horrible fleshy humans. And we'll talk about PSVR 2 later on, because that is the big release this week. But let's jump straight into the headlines. Number one, what is going on with E3? Ubisoft are the first major publisher to confirm their attendance at E3. They told GamesIndustry.biz, "We're still finalizing the details of our plans and look forward to sharing more soon." They're the largest publisher to commit to the Resurrected show so far. And we've reported, along with other places, that Xbox, Sony, and Nintendo won't be making their presence felt at the show, although Microsoft will hold a showcase around the same time. I go first to you, Andy Robinson. What's going on with E3?
Well, that is the question. I think if you ask most people, they'll ask you what is going on with E3. There's three things that are really kind of different this year. And that's that obviously there's not been an E3 for 4 years, a proper physical one anyway. Which is just, it's crazy to think, really. I mean, VGC was 1 month old or 2 months old the last time we went to an E3. And so they're trying to get back in the swing of things after 4 years and get all these companies that have spent the time in between with, you know, kind of their own digital events, talking direct to the consumers with varied levels of success. I mean, some have been kind of well-established, like obviously Sony's doing State of Play, whereas others like EA's show and Ubisoft shows were, I think a lot of consumers found really frustrating because of their kind of lack of bangers, really. So they've clearly decided to knock that on the head. And then obviously it's a new company that's running E3 as well. It's Reed Pop, which for anyone who's not familiar with them, they run all the PAX shows. They run like various Comic-Cons and stuff like that around the world. They are a big kind of established events company. They know what they're doing. So on paper, this is exactly what E3 needed. I mean, before the pandemic, E3 was already facing a lot of pressure to reinvent itself. It felt like, you know, it was kind of straddling between the old E3, which was built for business, and, you know, do you let consumers in? So there's that question still kind of hanging over it even now. So the Ubisoft scenario was really weird. So they came out in their earnings call last week and said they're absolutely going to be at E3 with a lot to show if it happens,
yeah.
was the key bit. Now, that confused a lot of people behind the scenes, from my understanding, because E3 is happening and Ubisoft is historically one of the biggest backers of E3. It loves E3. And I mean, I've spoken to people at Ubisoft and, you know, kind of anonymously, And they've made clear that E3 is going to be really big for them this year, like exactly as Yves Guillemot, their CEO, is saying here. Like, they've got a lot of stuff. So it's more about, I guess it's more about where that drops, because E3 is not just the physical show anymore. It hasn't been for a long time. Like, there was this IGN story that went out. They scooped me because I was working on it as well, about how Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft are not attending. And then I followed it up with just the Nintendo and Sony bit, really, because the Microsoft bit is less clear, because Microsoft weren't at the last E3, right? They weren't physically in the building. A lot of companies are not at E3 in the sense that they're in the building. EA is historically, in recent years, been next door, you know, has held its event next door to the convention center. Microsoft, last E3, was in the Microsoft Theater, which is, again, is next door. It's walking distance from the LACC.
Devolver were in the car park, for example.
Exactly, yeah. And for the majority of people, and this is the important bit, the majority of people, E3 is just about a time span, not a physical space, right?
Yeah.
Like, for the majority of people who love E3 and love all the announcements and the furore of the week, it's about all of this news coming at the same time in a big celebration of gaming. No one really cares whether they're in the building or not, right?
Yeah.
And that, to me, doesn't matter. So, Ken, coming back to Ubisoft will be present of the E3 week. I'm probably more confident with them than anyone else that they'll be in the actual show itself, because they've always supported it, and I know for a fact that they have kind of verbally committed to having a big booth and stuff. And obviously Microsoft are, you know, I've already announced they're going to have a press conference, right? And there's also IGN reported that they're talking to Repop about having their own separate event on the weekend for E3, which I also heard. So again, Microsoft are at E3, even if they're not in the building. So I think the scale seems to be like a Gamescom caliber thing. So last year's Gamescom, again, that was the first one in probably like 3 years, the pre-pandemic. Mm. I thought it was really good. But you're looking at the kind of the secondary tier publishers after the platform models. Xbox was there, but they had more of like an experiential booth. Like, they had like some, like a Starfield statue and things like that, right? And they had some like idea Xbox games, and it was cool. But, you know, the companies Capcom, that were there that were like that. Sega and PlayOn and like Ubisoft and Warner and Bandai Namco. And that's really what people should be expecting from E3, I think. I think it's a bit confusing that they've not announced yet, you know, some of these exhibitors. I mean, obviously Ubisoft has now confirmed itself and got ahead of an announcement. But it seems to be that the process is quite late. I mean, obviously Repop is new to this. It's their first one. Even though they are very, very good at running events. They are very, very, it is literally their business. They're a bit kind of late to signing all this on, I think. And I think that's where some of the confusion comes from. There might even be a little bit of trepidation among some publishers where they're sort of like, yeah, we definitely want to come to E3. We want to booth, you know, kind of give us some space. But we want to wait and see who else is announced before we commit. Like, nobody wants to be
the
only company at E3, right? But then that creates this awful chicken and egg situation where it's like, well, we can't announce anyone unless you commit. And then some companies might not want to commit until they see who's announced.
Yeah.
So it's this weird
Imagine
thing.
The programmers just kind of trying to create these vertical slices going, are we in or out? Do I have to make anything or not? Do I have to put anything on a USB key or not?
Well, that's a very good point, Pete, because that's one of the biggest challenges of coming back to physical events. On my kind of first point of the challenges of setting up this E3 is coming back from after a pandemic, is that most of these companies have just stopped doing any pre-release code. Mm. Like, that's not a trivial thing. If you're making an E3 demo, that's like 6 months of work, right?
Almost guaranteed you're going to miss your release date. Like, if you have to take out a year for it.
I mean, I worked on a game and we had an E3 demo. So I've exhibited at E3 as a developer with a demo. And even as an indie team of 15 guys, it took us months to make that demo. Like, it's a trivial thing. Like, I was like, oh, let's just lob a build out. and I'll just, you know, let them play. No, you have to like new tutorials have to be put in because it has to be built for a 5 to 10 minute experience to showcase the game.
That's what I want to see though, Andy. I want to see boardroom suits on stage covered in sweat. I want them out of their comfort zones. I want them missing their cues. I want mics fucking up everywhere. I want everything freezing.
Oh, we all want it. Yeah.
Like that is the E3 that I watched as a teenager, the staying up until 4 in the morning watching Sony shows. Like, I remember the first Xbox One and PS4 release year, so the 2013 shows, those were the big, like, and we support used games, and everyone pops, like, it's fucking WrestleMania. Hip-hop gamer's up there, he's spinning his belt, like...
I love hip-hop gamer, what a legend.
Those are the moments, and yeah, in terms of, like, I've had invites to E3 from agencies representing publishers, and it is all this, it's like the secondary tier, but it's the big names, but it's nothing super prominent. It's all Japanese stuff, really.
I think it's going to be, you need to look at Gamescom for the kind of mix of companies that you're going to get.
Yeah.
It seems to be, I think most of the Japanese companies will be there. And again, this is still, you know, nothing is 100% at the moment. Things can change.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like companies that have plans around that week, and they're trying to cement, you know, where those are going to be, those are the companies that are in the mix. So speaking of which, so that I can address all the people who are going to be angry at me on Twitter, so one of those is Konami. So I was going to put this on the site, but I've saved it for the podcast.
There we go.
So Konami is going to have a pretty big E3, from my understanding. I mean, I've reported on this in the past, probably too much, actually. It's dragging on a bit. We expected them to start talking about a lot of their stuff last year, which they did with Silent Hill, eventually, after that saga dragged on. But I also reported, I think last year or the year before, that they're reviving all of their IPs, really. Like, they've kind of opening up to collaborating with more developers, which they were a bit more hesitant to do as a, you know, big conservative Japanese company. So it's been brewing for a while, but I believe it's this E3 is going to be when you're going to start to see more of that. I mean, they've already had a big, you know, kind of a digital event to talk about Silent Hill. And I mean, how many games are there? 3 or 4 Silent Hill games they're working on, and yeah, a movie.
And like experiences and like,
yes,
all that kind of stuff as well.
So that is, you know, obviously I reported on that a long time ago, and that's reflective of, you know, their attitude as a company towards bringing these IP back. So I'm pretty sure they'll have an E3 booth, mm-hmm. and they'll probably be at a, you know, hold a lot of this stuff at a press conference, as a platform holder kind of media event. You know, which one that is, you can guess. I mean, I don't really know much about what PlayStation's doing, but if they were doing something, you would expect them to go with PlayStation,
yep,
considering their track record. But that said, they did announce they've done a lot of Metal Gear stuff in the past at Xbox press conferences. So, and it's the same story as I said before, really. There's a new Castlevania in addition to the Dead Cells DLC that they announced at the Game Awards. So that is the furthest along, I've been told. And there's, of course, this kind of much-discussed Metal Gear Solid 3 remake, which I also expect them to finally show. So the thing that's less clear is what they're going to do with these older Metal Gear games that everyone's really desperate to see kind of come back to storefronts, you know, so we can all play again on modern platforms. And, I mean, as of like a year, 2 years ago, that was in the plans. It's less clear now what they're going to do with that. I understand that there's some debate about, you know, the way that they should approach that. And I would imagine that Metal Gear Solid 3, the remake, is going to be somewhat of a test bed for that. Because you can imagine, you know, EA have just put out Dead Space, which has been very successful critically. And now everyone's pretty desperate for them to do the same for the second one, right? Which is my favorite. It would have been a bit odd if they put out a Dead Space collection before that, you know, with HD remasters and blah, blah, blah. And then it doesn't really fit. You can't really do both.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm expecting at this point is MGS3 remake. And then they'll kind of use that as a test bed for what comes next.
Mm, nice. So Pete, you're going to come over to E3 with us? Yeah, absolutely smash.
Well, since they closed the Hotel Figueroa, the last E3 I went to, I was in the Hotel Figueroa.
Did they close that?
I think they closed it or redid it. And I know for a fact I couldn't get in there the year after. But I remember spending something like $40 for one white Russian. And the guy made it with those, you know, those little packets of milk. Ugh. Disgusting. But yeah, E3 is always a very interesting, and I do like those kind of little breakout areas. And it's a little bit like we're heading out to WrestleMania for our Wrestle Me podcast in a few weeks' time. And like, it is just like you've got the main event that happens over 2 days in, you know, Inglewood or whatever. But then you've got at the Ukraine Center or Skid Row, you've got all the hotels that have little shows on, little WrestleCon kind of meet and greets and stuff like that. And it's that that's really interesting. You know, Effie's big brunch we saw in Dallas last year, the stuff that the Mexican setups are doing as well. Like, it's the vibe of sort of being there as an experience, but also it's just a time to put out all your press releases. And like back in like the late 90s, E3 was like all about like individual games were kind of like too small fry for companies, you know. It was about tech and then Metal Gear Solid 2 I think arrived and just turned man with a penguin stand and a TV screen and a ball full of branded pens into we need 20 minutes of in-engine footage and we don't have to be able to play them, but we just and I just think E3 needs these kind of like CEO or marketing director kind of like characters back. We where's our Reggie? Doug Bowser's gone missing. What's going on? We need three Keanu's. We just need men and women on stage doing crap jokes like David Brent. That's what E3's about. It's about things going wrong.
Speaking of huge global mainstream attention, this Microsoft Activision thing is never going to end. But thankfully, this week we had another chapter in the story. It took place in Brussels, where they put their case forward to the EU. And really, we could sit and talk about this, but there's only one person to talk about this subject with. And it's Chris Ring from GamesIndustry.biz. I got his take when he was literally about an hour off of his flight from Brussels. So enjoy that. So I'm here with Chris Ring from GamesIndustry.biz, a friend of the site. Chris, you were in Brussels yesterday. Tell us how it all went down.
Yeah, so yesterday, so Microsoft called this hearing. Right. So they've had these objections from the European regulator going, we don't like this. We don't like this. And Microsoft went, OK, we're going to argue this. We're going to present our case in a hearing. They summoned Sony. They summoned Google. They summoned Nvidia. They summoned all these big companies. This closed hearing that went on for quite a while, but actually not as long as was scheduled to go on. And then straight afterwards, they came out to tell everyone how it went. The big news out of it was the Nintendo contract had been signed. It's all a bit performative, really. I mean, Nintendo don't need a contract to Call of Duty on it, but they want to show that they mean what they say. And so that was at the beginning of the day, and then they announced straight afterwards that Nvidia GeForce Now was also going to get not just Call of Duty but all Xbox games. And they announced it in Brad Smith, who is a big multi probably billionaire political charming man, waved a piece of paper around to say, here's the Sony contract. It's probably got a lot of red pen on it, I'd say, and sitting in his thing. And then, yeah, that was sort of it. I suspect it went okay for Microsoft because the European Commission, that lot, are a little bit more open to what we call behavioural remedies. And Microsoft knows how to work the EU. They know because they've had their wrists slapped by this group quite a few times down the years, and they've had to adhere to certain rules and regulations and that kind of stuff. And I suspect this is going to be a continuation of that. So I think it probably went okay. I think the key thing for me is the Nvidia deal was more interesting than I think people realise.
And is that because of Microsoft's investment in cloud and kind of the direction of travel of that segment of the industry?
Yeah, so the regulators have got two chief concerns, right? One of them is the Call of Duty concern, which is if Call of Duty becomes an Xbox exclusive, either now or in the future, what does that mean? All the PlayStation players walk away? I mean, it's a complicated question because what we're talking about there is the network effect. So Call of Duty's audience alone isn't big enough to unsettle PlayStation, but if a huge number of people go across to Xbox, do their friends then come across? And does that create what we call a network effect? So that's what PlayStation's worried about. That's one argument. And Xbox's 10-year promise, putting it on Switch, all this kind of stuff is their way of countering that. Because what happens next is interesting to me. Because if the deal goes through, Activision Blizzard is in some ways a more efficient and effective games business than Microsoft Xbox is. Their marketing teams are bigger and more powerful. Their game studios are better run and more efficient. And so you sit there and go, are you going to put Activision Studios under Microsoft's current studio leadership team, or is Activision going to lead Microsoft Studios? It's such a big company. It's going to fundamentally change Xbox. So that bit's a really fascinating conversation I want to have with Microsoft, but obviously they're not ready to talk about that yet because the deal hasn't gone through. The other side, if the deal doesn't go through, what does Xbox do now? Because their whole pitch has been around subscriptions, it's been all about streaming and growing that market, and they feel they need a massive game to really drive that. And if they can't get one and they can't build one, is Microsoft going to get bored? And that is, for me, there's going to be, whatever outcome, there's going to be some real repercussions from this and a far more interesting conversation.
So where does that leave us? Where are the pieces in this ever-extending transfer saga?
Well, the FTC, the US regulator, is taking the whole thing to court. That's a little further out. They've only really just got started there. The EU obviously has now got all the information it needs to make a decision. The key one, and it's always been the key one from the very beginning, is the UK regulator, the CMA. And the UK is a massive market. Microsoft has a massive presence in the UK. So does Activision Blizzard. If the UK block this deal, sure, they may be able to take that hit, but I doubt it. So it's a real big deal. The UK regulator is, they're really concerned about big technology companies and the competitive effect of them buying big businesses. They've recently had Activision Blizzard try and throw stones at the UK by suggesting that if they block this deal, it turns the UK into Death Valley rather than Silicon Valley, which I actually think probably has the opposite effect than I think Activision Blizzard were hoping to have. And the UK regulator are not going to listen to this big, angry American man who wants his $70 billion. I think Microsoft's hoping that if the EU approve it, the CMA will fall in line. The big thing about this is the CMA have requested that Microsoft make what they call structural remedies. Structural remedies means changing something about the business that means they don't have to police it. So, for instance, selling off the Call of Duty brand and the Call of Duty studios. If Microsoft can carve off Call of Duty and sell that off, CMA will go, that's fine, you can buy the rest of it.
Well, Chris, I'm sure we'll speak to you again when you're in another conference room in the UK hearing the definitive decision. The real question is, who do we need to speak to and what governing body do we need to petition to get that Tony Hawk 3 and 4 remake?
I think this is the important thing. I think every regulator will accept this deal if Microsoft turned around and said, you know what, if you approve this deal, we will release Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 and 4, the remake, on all consoles, and we'll even get like Vicarious Visions to do it. I don't think we'd even got to phase 2, you know. I think every regulator would have gone, fair enough, you know. That's good for everybody. It's good for everyone.
Thanks a lot, Chris. So the main thing from that that I think is interesting, because truly I feel like this saga has gone like on way too long.
Yeah, I think we're all bored of talking about it.
Call of Duty on Switch, just top line, what is this, conciliatory? Is this kind of song and dance? Or is this putting the mobile version of Warzone onto Switch and making $1 billion? What do you think?
I think that few people care. I mean, does anyone care about... does anyone on Switch want Call of Duty? And does anyone who plays Call of Duty want to play it on Switch? I'd say the answer is probably no to both of those.
No.
It's, as Chris said, it's a big song and dance, right? It's Microsoft is putting on a show of bravado to get this deal across the line. And part of that is to... You know, like, Sony's not going to sign its deal, seemingly... So they're making them look as silly as they can, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if they sign a 10-year deal with, like, NVIDIA, like, with Nokia N-Gage for Call of Duty on that. Like, just to make a point. Oh, look, it's on, you know, we're on N-Gage. It's going to be on the Sega. We're going to sign a 10-year deal with them. If they make Dreamcast 2, they can have Call of Duty as well.
That weird ColecoVision that's coming out, not coming out.
Yeah, they're going to sign a deal with Tommy Tallarico for Call of Duty for the next 20 years. Yeah.
It's all bravado, right? It's all bravado. Like, no one wants to play Call of Duty on Switch. You know, the next Switch, yeah. Fine. But then that kind of kills their argument a bit about how they're chatting about how they're bringing it. This deal will bring it to 150 million new players. Well, not on Switch 2, it won't. Also overlooks massively how many people own a Switch and another console, which I'd say is a big chunk,
yeah.
Right? The more interesting thing in this from a like business perspective of like looking at this deal going through is the Nvidia one. Like they obviously they signed a deal with Nvidia, the 10-year deal to have Xbox PC games on Nvidia GeForce Now, their cloud streaming platform. And up until now, it was just like Xbox Cloud, like Game Pass, right? Game Pass Ultimate. And that was one of the big questions around this, because one of the main concerns from regulators was, one, how's this going to affect the console market? Like if PlayStation were to lose Call of Duty, you know, is that going to absolutely tank them? And but the bigger unknown one, which was probably a bit scary for Microsoft, was they were like, well, how's this going to affect the cloud a kind of industry, a cloud gaming industry, because that's so new that you're just speculating. So it really was, well, hold on, down the line, when that, if that becomes the biggest distribution of games, if you've got a monopoly on like the world's biggest console game, then what happens there? So in terms of symbolism, that's probably a much bigger deal than the Nintendo one.
Out of sort of a deal that would be quite hard to sign, I think turning up to Nintendo and Nvidia and going, do you want some money? Like that's the deal, basically, isn't it? Do you want our game that's really, really popular to sell, you know, maybe 100,000 units or however many units that they think they're going to get out? It's just, for me, certainly on the Call of Duty side, it reeks of either a cloud-based gaming solution or, do you know like how they do like FIFA Legacy on the Switch?
Yeah.
And it's like based on, and they just update the player roster from the...
It's going to be the original Modern Warfare 2.
Exactly. It's going to be it's going to be GameCube's Call of Duty Finest Hour, and it's going to be just updated skins every time. I want them to go further, though. You know, announce Soap McTavish in Splatoon.
Yeah, exactly.
Clear and out. Kevin Spacey in Smash Brothers. Let's do it.
Another Microsoft-adjacent story, because it's now in the Microsoft family. Shinji Mikami is reportedly leaving Tango Gameworks. This was reported this morning by True Achievements, who have reportedly seen an email which reads that Shinji Mikami has decided to leave Tango Gameworks in the coming months. Mikami-san has been a creative leader and supportive mentor to young developers at Tango for 12 years through his work on the Evil Within franchise, Ghostwire Tokyo, and of course, Hi-Fi Rush. Now, Mikami is a name that is lauded in the games industry for his time at Capcom working on Resident Evil, including Resident Evil 4, which most people would say is his best title. Andy, how did this strike you? You've been talking about this for a few years, about Mikami potentially wanting to leave Tango, but now it seems to be actually happening.
Oh, this is a really interesting story because, I mean, as you mentioned there, I reported on this in 2019.
Yeah.
That Mikami was kind of eyeing the exit door. This is going back 4 years now. And I had some really well-placed Japanese sources who basically, you know, kind of laid out the whole story, which was Resident Evil 3 Remake is A, coming soon. B, it's being worked on by a brand new company called M2. Not to be confused with the existing, there's two Japanese companies called M2, which is even more confusing. But basically, the story was this company is a Capcom-backed, like, independent developer by someone called Minami, who was, he worked at Capcom with Shinji Mikami. And he was, I believe, the boss of Platinum Games. So obviously they went there together. They have history together. And the story I was told was that, well, M2 was formed by both of them. Like the reason it's called M2 is because it's Minami Mikami. Yeah. And I was even shown a business card with Mikami's name on it, an M2 business card. Like, you know.
So it was that far along.
So that was the story. Allegedly, that was what was going to happen. It clearly didn't. Bethesda strongly denied it when I approached them. Mikami himself, I understand, denied it. But there's no, it's one of these, especially it's when you're reporting on Japanese stories, obviously there's a language barrier. But there's a lot of smoke here, you know, so it always led me to believe that there was something in this, especially because obviously every other part of my story became true. At the end of that year, they announced M2, it's Minami, they're working on Resident Evil. It's all right. Okay. So that kind of strengthens your confidence in the story. So there was a lot of chatter that I would never kind of be confident enough to write down in words about him being, you know, kind of eyeing the exit door at that time. I mean, you only have to look at the circumstance around it as well. it's really not, it's a rare occurrence that a Japanese studio sells to a foreign company. That's quite rare. Usually there's a lot of culture and unwritten rules where a lot of the Japanese companies kind of look after each other. It's very rare that you see a Japanese company go bust. The base understanding I have is that, and Mikami has said this himself, when he sold to Bethesda in 2010, because he formed Tango Gameworks, he had some financial struggles after their first game. Bethesda had kind of saved him, really. From what I'm hearing from people, I don't believe he would have sold to Bethesda if he's doing great, right? The unwritten rule for these guys making their independent studio is that at some point they're going to sell it for tens or hundreds of millions. That's the point, right? You kill yourself. This is hard, creating any company. But a game development company, it's bloody hard. But the reward at the end is that someone buys it. You don't just let it, you know, die off. Or even there, what are you going to do? You cash in, right, at some point. That's what happens. I mean, I remember when I started working in the games media, it was always very shocking, like, whenever a big independent developer, like, sold to a big guy. It's like, wow, you know, when BioWare went at EA. And I'm trying to think of some other examples. But and you was like, oh, that's incredible. Like, but it's not, because those guys made BioWare, and then you do it for, like, 10, 20 years, and then when the first publisher offers 100 mil, you go, see ya. And then you work your claws for a couple of years and you leave. That happens at every single company. Yeah. This is not unusual.
So
the thing that is unusual is that Mikami, because he's allegedly, I believe he said this himself, was in some facing some financial trouble. He's clearly sold it to Bethesda for less than he would have hoped from the work that he's put in, you know, from establishing all these people and putting out these big, big games. So he's probably not got the payday he wanted. He's left Capcom in the first place to go and be independent and get more independence. So he definitely doesn't want to work for another, like, kind of overbearing publisher, you would think, because he's left in the first place to do Platinum and then left again to make his own. If he was going to end up anywhere else, I wouldn't be surprised if he did go back to Capcom, you know, to work with Manami. Capcom, I understand, has changed a lot since he left. I believe Manami, I'm told that he's being treated really well, you know, that they're happy working there. Platinum Games obviously is going for a big change as well. His former company, they've got a new boss there, ex-Nintendo guy. They seem to be, just even in the last kind of 6 months or a year that's happened, better run. They seem to be a bright future over there, a lot of ambition. That could be somewhere. But again, it's a guess. And I should say, by the way, and we've not said this at all, if this is true, it's not confirmed.
Yes.
Like, I've just gone through all of that rant, but we still, Bethesda are yet to, kind of at the time of recording this podcast, they're yet to respond to this story, which has come from True Achievements. But, you know, like, it's a pretty solid story. They're not, it doesn't seem many ifs and buts. They're saying it's an email and it's written by this guy and this is what it says.
Yeah.
And it kind of supports everything that I've been expecting to happen.
And Pete, just briefly, what do you think about this kind of... So obviously Mikami is now went to Bethesda, and then Bethesda became under the Microsoft umbrella, and more companies come under Microsoft's umbrella. What do you think about these auteurs kind of getting sucked up into the system, then breaking away and starting their new thing again, just repeating that cycle?
I always find it very satisfying that they adopt the branding so hard that they can sometimes change physically as well as mentally. I think Toshihiro Nagoshi, the Yakuza guy, you look at pictures of him before he started work on Yakuza and he looked like an absolute dweeb. Now he looks like a mad 70s Japanese pop star. His face is strange and puffy and he wears leather jackets and he looks like a sex person, Lynn. It's great stuff. I love it. I love people who kind of adopt their brand that hard. It's wonderful.
That's why since I started working for VGC, more Nintendo t-shirts have turned up at my door, just all this retro shit.
Stop it, Jordan. You'll get criticism from Twitter. You've had a week of it. I can't remember what it was about this week.
Nintendo fans never shout at me. It's genuinely never happened, and I don't know how. Speaking of a fan base that likes to shout at me, PlayStation State of Play returns tonight. There was a really kind of out-of-nowhere announcement saying, get ready for some new anticipated games from our third-party partners, as well as the first glimpse at 5 PlayStation VR 2 games set to arrive later this year. Then settle in for more than 15 minutes of all new gameplay and details on Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, which is Rocksteady's next game. Now, this is an interesting one because Sony's got pretty quiet back half of the year, apart from Spider-Man. So, and this is third-party partner games. So is this a case of stuff that they are co-marketing? Like, what are you expecting from this, Andy? A quiet show or what?
Well, from what I said earlier, I'm not expecting much at all, because I think usually they're a bit underwhelming. But this is an excellent way of dating our podcast, isn't it?
When they announce Metal Gear Solid 3.
Should I record another bit? I think I'll record another bit and we can edit it. I think it's going to be spectacular.
Wow.
I couldn't believe when they came out and announced The Last of Us 3. That was crazy.
Indeed. I don't know. They're usually... Well, it's difficult not to be cynical. A lot of these platform holder digital events... are kind of like happen because they have marketing obligations, like they literally legally have to do them, like especially right. because that thought is emphasized for me by the fact that this is for Suicide Squad. They've announced that Suicide Squad is in it. It's the Suicide Squad one, so it does the cynical part of me is already looking and going, well, they've just chucked some VR games they've got onto the Suicide Squad set of play that they have to do by, you know, the end of the fiscal year, you know, which is coming up. But I don't know.
It's interesting because the last couple of these, it was like, they did one for Gotham Knights, they did one for Hogwarts Legacy, they did one for Suicide Squad. So clearly Warner has just like driven a boatload of money up to them and they're like, just get us in front of these state of plays. I also think that on the week that PlayStation VR 2 came out, with one of the main criticisms being there's barely any exclusive stuff at launch and there doesn't seem much down the line, they need to come out here and be like, here is the thing, they honestly need a first party Sony VR game kind of like in the pipeline.
I think they'll probably come out and just say we're going to give you the Gotham game, but you're allowed to use VR, but just for the menus or something. Like, all of our menus are VR, but not the game itself, just the menus. So like, because even, like, VR2's just come out, and it's already looking, would it be fair to say, all a little bit thin and a little bit Me Too and a little bit kind of, like, we've got nothing. Because we all know that which studios would be working on these titles, and they've all got other things on, haven't they?
So that's the thing, like, PlayStation VR2, from the actual tech perspective, practically couldn't be better, but it kind of falls apart when you get to the games. Like, even one of the big games that they're talking about, Gran Turismo 7, which has its VR update, it's just in the game it's when you're racing as VR, the menus are a flat screen, like that kind of cinema mode. Like, they haven't changed any of that stuff. Like, you don't get to sit in the cafe in VR, which was greatly disappointing to me. but when you get into the race, you're like, this is a transformatively good VR experience. Same way, like Horizon, brilliant. And obviously, in this VGC parish, we are big Mizuguchi fans, so having Tetris Effect and Res Infinite is like an essential part of any VR lineup. But yeah, that's probably a good time to transition into our PSVR.
I do believe, just to add to that, I do believe I've just seen a leak crop up on my Discord about what's that VR game that he's working on for ages? I've not seen Humanity.
Yeah, Enhances Humanity.
Apparently a demo has just cropped up on the PSN backend, so that's probably another...
Now we're talking, get him in here. I mean, the last time I spoke to Mizuguchi before he could say that he was doing PSVR 2 stuff, when I mentioned PSVR 2, he was very much like, there you go.
Mustn't like you very much, mate. He told me he was doing PSVR 2 before they announced the thing.
Mine was being recorded, not these back alley conversations.
Oh, mine was being recorded, but he just knows I'm a cool dude.
You can... competitive scoop monsters, both of you. I can't believe I'm involved in this project.
We're just every time I mention Mikami, Andy has to one up me and be like, oh well, I was a Mikami fanboy, a Mizuguchi fanboy before you.
So
were
you don't even know his name.
I knew,
mate.
You were gonna say that.
I've been in his car.
Oh, I've taken pills with him and listened to the Res Infinite soundtrack. I'm cool. Anyway, we will chat more about PSVR2 after this.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love.
Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So PSVR 2 is out this week for those of us with almost £1,000 to spend. The launch lineup in terms of exclusives is pretty thin, but as you can read in my review on VGC, I thought the headset itself is fantastic. I don't think it's too expensive when you compare it with the equivalent PC headsets. VR is just an expensive enthusiast hobby. And my question for you two, as hardcore gamers, you know, what would Sony have to do to make you pay £500 for one of these headsets?
I would need a year's supply of, is it Calms? What's that stuff that stops you vomiting on ferries?
Tums or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. I just need, because I just cannot. I bought from CEX. It's from Sex, isn't it? But weirdly.
Sex.
I bought the first Oculus Rift and then went off on to experiment with the first PlayStation headset, and there's something in my brain that will not allow me to play any of these games. I was all right with that. There was a game that was just all about heading a football. I was all right with that because it's very static, it's very calm, no one's moving around, there's nothing moving. But yeah, any VR experience I just cannot handle. So that whole kind of raft of games is just completely, you know, the Half-Life game, it's completely out of bounds for me, unless maybe the tech improves significantly.
You should give it a go, mate, because yeah. I'm the same.
Right.
I'm the same. When I went to Gamescom last year, I was penciled in to see a lot of kind of VR games, and it was so embarrassing because the first couple I'd just get sick and just say, look, I can't play this, and then I'd have to watch the developer play it.
Right, okay, that's fair.
Because I couldn't do it anymore. Like these big, like mentor, it was like Walking Dead VR game, right?
Right.
Which couldn't be more sick and juicy. Slashing zombies and sprinting and looking behind you and but in the end, I was just heading up to these VR appointments going, look, I can't play this. Can you play it? And I'll just watch. But Half-Life Alyx is the one, probably the only, it's probably one of the meatiest VR games anyway, but I finished it and I absolutely fucking loved it.
Right, yeah.
Like, it's a 5 out of 5. It's one of the best games I've played in the last recent years, and it has multiple, I guess a lot of games do that style, it has multiple kind of like traversal options. You can, that kind of help with sickness. And there's the one that I was using where you teleport instead of moving with a stick.
Yeah.
You point where you want to go with a little kind of HUD item and it will just teleport you there. And then no sickness at all.
Right, yeah. I thought, because like, a lot of like the cockpit-based ones, you know, your elite games and stuff, like it's a lot easier to manage, I think. It's just all about the motion.
That's exactly it. The thing that makes me sick is someone's going to correct me on the comments, but it's a Neanderthal thing where when your body sees motion but doesn't sense it, it thinks you've been poisoned, so it makes you sick. So that's the thing, like when you're at physical momentum but you're not feeling any wind. That's why putting a fan in front of you when you're playing VR helps as well.
Oh, does it? Right.
Your body, yeah, it does. Ah. Yeah, it does.
So you would absolutely fucking hate Horizon because the... So I'll demonstrate it for you now.
He's got it on his hands.
Boxing gloves on to walk in the most, like, so there's three settings, comfort settings in Horizon. In the most extreme one, which is the one I did because I had to know, you walk like this, which like a bushwhacker walk almost. Like, and then to turn around, you hold one of the triggers and like kind of just gesture to the side.
Kaylee.
Like, yeah, it's very, and then there's like, to jump, you have to throw your hands forward. It's very full on.
That's very involved.
The thing with Horizon is when you get the bow and you're like quickly grabbing imaginary arrows from your quiver and becoming Legolas, it was so good. Like, it completely tricked me. It was like, this is obviously like a very wish fulfillment-y kind of, oh, look what VR can do, but it totally sold me.
Yeah.
And it's one of these experiences that is one of those VR experiences that I think are fantastic, but the thing needs about 10 times as many of them to justify people spending this amount of money, especially after people spent all that money on the frankly terrible PSVR one. Like, the fact that that ever came out, it was basically PS3 technology.
I really hated PSVR.
Bolted to a plastic box. Compared to that, PSVR 2
with 50 wires.
Yeah, with like a
and two boxes. Yeah. Turbine.
Whereas the PSVR is literally one USB-C cable that plugs into the front. It's like, right. It's unbelievable. See, when I got my unit, I was like, have I been robbed? Like, why is this box so light? But yeah, it's I think it's really good. I wish I had more stuff to play on it. Interestingly, there's a few games that if you don't have 7 feet in every direction, won't start at all.
Oh, really?
They'll like scan your room and be like, you can't play this.
You fucking are a pauper.
You need to get, so you need a PS5, a 600 quid headset, and a new house.
Wow.
Pretty much. You need like a five-a-side football pitch to try and play it on.
I talked myself into buying a 4090 this month, but I don't think I'd get away with. I think I need an aircraft hangar.
Yeah. It's weird though, because when it's got like a pass-through mode, so it's got a camera on the outside so you can see like what's going on. You can like check your phone and stuff like that. And that's how it scans your area. So I was looking around my office and it was pretty good. It was like, okay, that's floor, that's desk. But then like I have these glass cabinets behind me and it freaked the fuck out. And it was like, you can stand in there if you want. So if I just like hooked straight through one of those glass cabinets, took out my fucking Watch Dogs 1 Collector's Edition, threw it on the floor, like it would have no problem with that.
I'm a hologram man. I do not respect physics anymore.
The first night I tried it on, I played through basically all of Tetris Effect in one sitting, and I took it off and I was like, where's the slam tent? Like, I felt like I just had a really heavy one.
You'd rearranged your entire room.
The glass was like shredding my wrists. But I still think the best way to play VR, and this is a pure boring way, is like with a normal PlayStation controller and the headset, like for Gran Turismo or Tetris or Rez, because you ignore all this kind of like YMCA pish and you get like the immersion of something like GT7, which looks amazing in VR. I'm a famous GT7 hater, however, but the VR kind of integration in that from the gameplay perspective is very impressive.
Right.
But yeah, it's a weird, almost feels like an obligation from Sony rather than PlayStation wanting to do it kind of thing. And I think it will get decent support. I wouldn't be surprised if Horizon is the biggest game that ever comes out for it from like a PlayStation perspective.
It's like you say, like it's a bigger deal for Sony probably than it is for PlayStation. It's just there's natural synergy between those two things. Like if you're going to have an advanced premium VR headset, then you should probably be making games for it. I mean, I said my piece like a year or a couple of years ago, and I got abused for it on social media, which we get abused for everything on social media. That it just feels like it felt like a bit of a distraction to me. Like games now, especially the sort of games that Sony make, take so many resources, so many people, so long. You know, 5 million people, I believe it was just over 5 million people bought PSVR 1. That's not, I mean, VR is profitable, by the way. Unlike all this other stuff, like Metaverse and all the rest of it, VR makes money. It's a profitable industry.
Oh, does it?
So it's not the same thing. It is a profitable a niche, but one that makes money and could be a lot bigger in the future. But it's still a big niche, like 5 mil
on 120 million
PS4s. Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like just a module that you drag into your middleware, just sort of go, right, you know, VR, it's now VR.
Yeah.
You know, like how gamers get really annoyed and they sort of go, well, why can't they just a redone version of, you know, a game from like the 80s? Why can't they just create a new one? Why can't they just create Grand Theft Auto 3 with all of these new bells and whistles automatically, just use AI or something? And they have no respect for the actual development. But surely VR, out of all of the things you can do to reinvigorate a brand, drag in the VR module I've just invented in my mind. It can't be as hard as retexturing. You just got to make sure it's stable, it runs at a high refresh rate, and you just, you know, dial down the graphics and drag in the module.
Well, you kind of got that with a lot. Like Fallout and Skyrim came to VR, and like it's weird that they're not on. Well, it's not that weird considering they're Microsoft properties now. But it would have been nice for them to have been on the thing on day one. Although, yeah, It needs big games. But yeah, that's our question for you lot, the VGC nation. I'm going to copyright that term for the merch. What is the interest level in VR, and what would PSVR 2 have to do to get you interested? Is it games? Is it being cheaper? I imagine it's the latter more than the former. Send your responses to podcast@videogameschronicle.com, podcast@videogameschronicle.com. They all go directly to Andy, so use that information as you will. Well, thank you very much for listening to the first episode of VGC, a video games podcast. You can follow myself on Twitter @JordanMidler. It's a great time. Andy @AndyPlatonic and Pete @PeteDonaldson. Say goodbye, Andy.
Goodbye, Andy.
Say goodbye, Pete.
Farewell all.
And we will see you next week.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.